Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better. When his wife Beverly Wise was murdered in their San Bernardino, California home in 1977, and their two oldest children were kidnapped, Claude Wise feared that he would never see them again. But 2 years later, in 1979,
detectives told him that they believed his children were still alive. In fact, their investigation would reveal that the children had been hiding in plain sight, eating out in restaurants and attending Sunday school. But despite multiple arrests and the lengthiest and most expensive trial in San Bernardino's history, Brandy Summers and Tiffany Wise's whereabouts remain unknown over 40 years later. Claude Wise and his youngest daughter, Stacy, are still searching, and they believe that there are many people who are still alive who hold the answers to this mystery. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Brandy Summers and Tiffany Wise. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Okay, welcome back, everyone.
Welcome again. Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us for part two of this insane story and hanging in there. For those of you who have not listened to part one, definitely stop right now and go do that because this will not make any sense.
Now, also break out your whiteboard when you're listening to part one and do several diagrams.
Yes, absolutely.
Because
this
still is a very, very confusing sense. It's a very, very confusing story.
It is. And again, I mentioned this in the last episode, but if you have not gone to our blog, which is andthentheyweregone.com, I think it's just /blog. But if you go to that, the photo gallery for this episode does have a diagram of where all of the sightings were and a diagram of all of the major players in this case.
So you don't need your whiteboard.
No, but it would probably still help. Before we dive in, though, I want to thank those of you who have joined us over on Patreon. Thank you, Kveta B. We really appreciate you. And if you would like to join us, you can do so at patreon.com/attwgpod. But let's now get to part two of Tiffany and Brandy's story. All right, when we left off, it was December of 1979, and San Bernardino police had arrested Juanita and Mike Iwakuri, Lee Kasner, and Karen Carino for various charges, including accessory to murder and kidnapping. They also later arrested Vivian Kasner. Roy was already in jail for kidnapping and attempted murder against both his own mother and his then-wife, Connie. Then January of 1980 was basically filled with extraditions, paperwork, and, you know, things like that. So let's skip ahead and talk about where everyone is in February of 1980. As I mentioned in the last episode, most of the charges against Roy that he was facing in Oregon were dropped because his mother straight up said that she would lie to protect her son. According to Connie, Roy also wrote her several letters from jail while he was awaiting trial, begging her to change her story and to get back together with him. So the assault happened in October of 1979. She filed for divorce in December. He said that police wouldn't convict him if they were together. So he's like, just say that you made it up because you were mad at me.
Mad that I broke your arm in eight places and...
like it has to be amputated?
Had to have you... now you just have one arm.
Yeah. So her arm at this point has not been amputated, but it also is not healing. So that was the thing. So like it was broken so badly that obviously the doctors said it and hoped that it would heal. But, you know, 5 weeks after the attack, it was not healing at all. So that's when they're saying it's going to have to be amputated. They were still kind of hopeful. It was not looking good. But yeah, that was Roy's plan. He's like, say you were mad at me. Say it was just a misunderstanding.
My bad.
So while Connie chose not to get back together with him, Roy only ended up standing trial for a misdemeanor assault, which carried a maximum 1 year sentence in the Deschutes County Jail. So in February of 1980, he was sentenced to 1 year. And again, it just goes to show like how domestic violence was treated in the late 70s. I mean, barely a crime. Like he choked her until she passed out, tried to kill her. Her arm has to be amputated. And yeah, he got a year in county jail.
Tried to kill her in a very dramatic fashion. Too.
Yeah.
Like something you would see out of a spy movie.
Yeah.
But then went wrong.
Vivian Kasner, who was Roy's ex-girlfriend, had been arrested for suspicion of accessory to kidnapping and held on a $10,000 bail. But she ended up being released with no charges filed.
Because there was no evidence.
Well, yeah. I mean, basically. Vivian's brother-in-law, Lee, was formally charged in February of 1980 with accessory to kidnapping and felony child stealing. His bail was set at $100,000. And according to witnesses, he was the last person to have been seen with the girls in early 1980. Vivian's sister, Juanita Iwakiri, was arrested on February 8th for accessory to kidnapping and released on her own recognizance. Juanita's husband, Michael, wasn't arrested until March of 1980. He was charged with perjury, accessory to kidnapping, and felony child concealment. But before his arraignment, the felony child concealment charge was dropped, but an accessory to murder charge was added.
Oh.
Yes, because this is stemming back to his grand jury testimony, in which he says that he didn't know the kids, they had never cared for them, never seen them before in his life, but that contradicted earlier statements he had made to police. And San Bernardino police say that because his perjury that they say could theoretically throw investigators off of the trail of the real killer, that he is acting as an accessory to the murder.
This is all very loose.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They're really reaching.
Oh, yeah. And again, back to what I was talking about in the last episode of them saying the quiet part out loud, the San Bernardino chief of police admitted to newspaper reporters that this was just a pressure tactic. They didn't think that Michael was in California helping to murder Beverly or anything like that. They just said that he lied about caring for the children and that made him an accessory to murder because it was basically throwing them off this theoretical course of finding the real killer. They later used the same tactic on Lee Kasner and also added an accessory to murder charge to him. As you may guess, the result of these tactics were mixed at best, and even saying that is a stretch because the girls have never been found, so clearly it wasn't very effective.
No.
By July of 1980, all of the charges except for perjury had been dropped against Michael Iwakiri. Lee Kasner reached a plea deal with prosecutors. He ended up pleading guilty to one count of concealing a minor. The other charges were all dropped, and he was sentenced to time served and 3 years probation.
So he pled guilty to concealing a minor?
Yeah.
But didn't give any testimony on who that minor was or...
No, and that's the thing. Like, so they apparently, just accepted that plea deal.
It's just like, yeah, I'll cop to that because I can just go home today.
Yeah, and they're like, okay, cool, but yeah, no actual information came out of that plea deal, which is mind-boggling to me.
So it seems like all of this was a dog and pony show for the public.
Well, no, I don't think it was because I really do think they thought this would work because...
I mean, not if you're showing your hand to the media who the defense attorneys are also watching.
Yeah, no, I really do. I mean, as dumb as that is, like, I do think they thought this was working, but then by the summer, it was all falling apart.
Oh, weird.
And so that's why they were just kind of letting people go at that point.
I mean, I think a smarter tactic probably would have been like, okay, we have enough evidence to show that Roy is circumstantial, but we've narrowed it down to Roy being the one that
like orchestrated
did this, yeah, and is the one ferrying the kids back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
maybe we don't say anything and we just watch Roy.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you would think that the smarter move,
find the kids.
Yeah, and not necessarily watching just Roy though, because there were plenty of times,
all of the other players too.
Yeah, because there were plenty of times that Roy was not with the children. Right? Sure. Like the kids, I don't believe were ever seen in Oregon, for instance, which is where Roy was living with his wife. Maybe the smarter move would have been to keep an eye on these people instead of just throwing them all in jail.
Yeah.
Because so by that summer, like I said, everything was falling apart with all of these trumped up charges. Juanita was still awaiting trial by this point. And Karen was here in Virginia. Like, California hadn't bothered to extradite her yet. So she was just here chilling. Like, she was released. She was just like living her life across the country. And all of this was, of course, leading up to the main event, which was Roy Summers' trial. This trial began in June of 1982, and despite the fact that these other charges were kind of falling apart, I have to feel that prosecutors like had to be pretty confident going in. Because again, they did have all of these witnesses in multiple states saying that they had seen the girls with people connected to Roy.
Only if they were actually going to come to trial and testify.
Well, and they did. They did. To give you a clearer picture, though, of exactly how confident they must have been that they had the right people, like the people who were involved in this, I want to read part of Robert Aldridge's grand jury testimony. Now, if you recall from last week's episode, Aldridge was Juanita's lawyer. He said that Juanita called him up in 1977, not long after the murder and kidnappings. So here's what he had to say. And as a side note, Juanita went by the nickname Tiny. Question. And can you tell the jury how it is this contact with the defendant came about? Answer. The phone call came into my office. I answered the phone. I don't believe there was a secretary in between on that. And a person on the other end said, "This is Tina Iwakiri. Becky Boyer recommended me to you or referred me to you. Has she told you about me?" Question. What did you say? Answer. I said, "No, she had not." The person then said, "Well, I've got an adoption question I wanted to ask you about." I then said, "Wait a second. I don't handle black market or under the counter types of adoptions. I will handle them if they are health and welfare type of adoption or if there is some religious or other organization involved that has a child, but I don't take things under the counter, next of kin or otherwise." Question. Did the defendant make any statements to you after you told her that? Answer. Yes. She responded, "No, that is not what I'm talking about. The children are already here. They are my sisters." I believe she said there were two girls. I think that she said that they were ages 2 and 5, but I am not totally sure about that. Question. So you did not accept the case at this point? Answer. No. Question. Did you question her further or did she volunteer information at that point? Answer. At that point in time, I remarked to her that it sounded like a messy situation with a sister involved. And she then stated, "Well, they weren't really the sister's children, that actually they were, I believe, boyfriends, the sister's boyfriend's children, and that he had brought them up from California. That one was his and one was his wife's, his California wife's by a prior marriage." So there's a little bit more to it, but I want to like pause here and kind of get your first thoughts on this.
My first thoughts are any good defense attorney is going to pick that apart.
Meaning what? Like how?
There was a lot of, "I believe, I don't know, nothing was definitive." Knowing the circumstances of this case, yes, everything fits, but it's really circumstantial.
All right, so let's go on a little bit more. Question. Do you recollect what she told you about the mother? Answer. Now, this varied throughout the conversation. Her initial indications at the beginning of the conversation were simply that the natural mother was the first wife of the boyfriend and was in California. Later in the conversation, the natural mother was dead in some manner. I believe her words were, quote, "She's dead." Toward the end of the conversation, she stated that the natural mother had in fact been killed. I don't remember whether she used the word killed or murdered, but in any event, had been killed, had not died a natural death. She also stated that the boyfriend had been involved in this killing. Question, she did? Answer, yes, sir. Question, how did she state that? Answer, I believe her words were at that point in the conversation that the natural boyfriend was about half crazy and that he had murdered or killed the California wife and that she was concerned that he might also physically harm the children or might physically harm her, Tiny. Question, Tiny was concerned about that? Answer, yes. She indicated a great deal of concern several times in the conversation that the boyfriend would physically harm her. She indicated at approximately this point in the conversation that she wanted to proceed with the adoption while they were gone. Apparently, the boyfriend and sister were gone. She didn't say where, and she wanted to proceed with the adoption while they were gone without letting them know so that when they came back, it would all be done and through and they couldn't do anything about it. I told her there were two problems. Number one, that again, in order to get an adoption, you had to terminate the parental rights, and that required either service on them of the appropriate papers, or she can supply them with the appropriate papers, either one of which they would have to be aware of. And number two, that there was no way you could do all of this in the time period she was talking about. It simply wasn't long enough. I also told her at this point that she had to be concerned about the natural father, that he was there in California and was looking for them. Obviously, he was not going to consent to a waiver and was not going to be deemed to have abandoned the children, and all this meant that she probably could not get a termination. Question, how did they respond to that advice? Answer, she reiterated again that she was very concerned about the children, that she wanted to see this done, and at this time point in time, she wanted to proceed if she could at all do so. But I again told her I could see no way. I told her there were two problems. Number one, in terms of the case itself, it was not a case I would take. I believe my exact words were, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole for $1 million. Secondly, that she was going to have to be very careful of what she did because I didn't think there was any way she could get a termination under those circumstances, and I again described the problems. And I told her I also felt she should take a very close look at what she was doing in terms of possible criminal involvement, that she might be getting herself right into the middle of an accessory aiding and abetting or a conspiracy situation as to at least the one child that appeared to me to be a possible case of kidnapping. She should take a careful look at it. All right. So now, given that, what do you think?
Okay. So here we have the babysitter contacting a lawyer saying that she now wants to adopt the kids.
Right, because she's fearing for their safety.
Based on her, did she say her belief that Roy murdered the mom?
Yes.
Or possible involvement with murder.
No, that he did it. Like, according to the lawyer, like, she was under the impression that he killed Beverly. Whether Roy told her that, whether Vivian told her that, that is not clear in this testimony.
Okay.
But yes, that she was under the belief, and she was afraid that Roy would also harm the children.
Okay, so still not clearly an indictment directly of the murder. It's at this point that the murder itself is still hearsay.
Sure.
However, kids are involved. Those particular kids are involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to unpack there. I mean,
well, to me, coming from a lawyer, I think this is pretty damning testimony, right? Because I have to believe that he's credible. I have to believe that he didn't just make this up out of nothing. I have to believe that this conversation happened.
Sure. As far as the whereabouts of the children, yes.
Right. This doesn't, I guess, definitively prove that Brandy and Tiffany were with Juanita, but it would be a pretty weird coincidence if they're talking about two other girls. If Roy Summers and Vivian brought these two girls, brought Brandy and Tiffany to Juanita's house, how did they get them, right? Like, how did they end up with them in the first place if Roy Summers was not somehow involved in Beverly's death? No, it's not like forensic evidence or whatever, but when you're building a circumstantial case, there's no logical explanation. There's no logical way that he could have gotten possession of these two children without being involved in her death.
I just think that it's a little dangerous to pursue a murder charge on circumstantial evidence. And this is all circumstantial evidence.
This, to me, is a lot more solid than a lot of cases you hear about. Given the fact that this testimony came from a lawyer and not like a diner waitress or a neighbor or whatever, is probably why, out of all the people arrested who weren't named Roy Summers, Juanita faced the most serious potential consequences. So after this whole grand jury thing happened and all that information was kind of out there, Juanita went to trial for her charges. And on May 15th, 1981, after a six-week trial, she was found guilty of second-degree kidnapping of Tiffany Wise. She faced up to 5 years in prison. Her husband, Michael, told the Idaho Statesman that his wife was innocent, saying that he and his wife never cared for the children. He said, quote, "What can we do to make the judicial system believe we are innocent? If we had any knowledge of this case, do you think I would let my wife go to prison and sit there hurting and let my kids hurt if all they wanted is their whereabouts?" End quote. And that's a good point.
I mean, while that's a good point, do you then think that this lawyer made this up?
No, I don't. But I do think he's still making a good point. Like, I see where he's coming from, because like, that's the problem that a lot of people had with this whole case. As strong as I do think this circumstantial case is, but the question of why would so many people work together to continue to conceal the whereabouts of these children? Like, that's a big question. What is in it for them? Why are they doing this?
Yeah.
So no, but I don't think the lawyer is making it up. I think that the lawyer is absolutely credible. I do think that Juanita called him and asked about adopting these two kids. And I don't think it was like two other random children. I think it was Brandy and Tiffany. But why? Like, why are they getting involved in this? Why would Roy have come 6 years later and murdered his wife? Like, none of it makes sense. Like, all the puzzle pieces fit together, but like, the picture is not what's on the box.
Yeah. There's no direct motive behind any of this.
Yeah. It's completely baffling. And that question became a cornerstone of Roy's defense when he eventually went to trial. That, and he contended that police lied and intimidated witnesses. The map, for instance. We talked about that before. So it's this map with a route from California to Utah on it that was found at the crime scene that was traced back to Roy. Roy's ex-wife, Luella Tullis, said that she only told police that that was her map because detectives told her that her fingerprints were on it. And she said that they also told her that if basically she didn't tell them what they wanted to hear, that she'd go to jail and she'd never see her children again. Even Connie, Roy's ex-wife, who needed to have her arm amputated after his assault, said that police also put words in her mouth, saying that despite the reports, she never said that Roy had told her that Barbara had been slaughtered like a cow. The defense also said that the witnesses who claimed to have seen the girls, like all the neighbors and everybody, were just simply mistaken, that they had been shown the same photos of Tiffany and Brandy that had previously run in newspapers, and that's why they recognized them.
Yeah, no lineups.
Yeah, and that's actually in one of the articles, the early articles of this investigation, the reinvestigation. It was actually kind of funny because they did a bullet point list of like all of the unusual things that detectives were doing in this investigation. And one of them was their tape recording all of the interviews. But another one was that they showed a baby lineup two people. So they were showing a lineup photos of the victims as opposed to your traditional lineup photo of, you know, potential perpetrators. So yes, they were showing like a six pack of photos or whatever to potential witnesses saying, are these the girls that you saw? But Roy's attorneys contend that they were showing them pictures that had been published in newspapers that had been on the news. So these people had seen those pictures before and they're like, oh yeah, I've seen, yeah, looks familiar. Yes, I can 125% believe that all of the investigation methods were flawed, that the identifications were probably flawed. But again, like take Karen, Roy's sister, right? The neighbor saw two little girls and a man matching Roy's description at her house. Is the defense's contention that it was just two other random little girls and another random man, you know, matching Roy's description?
I don't know. You can't tell any white people apart right now.
I mean, that's true.
I'm not coming to his defense. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but Karen, Roy, like nobody is saying like, oh no, that wasn't Brandy and Tiffany. That was actually these other people, right? Like they're not offering any alternate explanations. They're just saying that the identifications were flawed. It wasn't them.
Yeah. I mean, sure. They can say that. This is a jury trial at this point. I mean, so they're trying to.
I mean, it's reasonable doubt, right?
Yeah. Like, they're trying to put doubt in the juror's mind.
Right. And, you know, to be fair, like they don't have to prove that it was two other little girls that they saw.
Correct.
They just have to prove that it wasn't 100% Brandy and Tiffany.
Correct.
To go along with what Roy's lawyers are contending, that this is a corrupt investigation, Detective Meyer was not a good dude. During the investigation, he was apparently trying to write a book about the whole thing and had asked for permission to like take a bunch of the files and stuff. And his superiors are like, no, like you can't do that. You know, yes, it's the 70s, but that's still not cool. He also concealed evidence. So Luella, you know, who was Roy's ex-wife, who's the one who provided his alibi in Utah, said that she had given Detective Meyer a calendar that had Roy arriving on March 29th on it. So she gave it to him. He never like turned it in as evidence. And so she brought this up and the judge ordered Detective Meyer to produce this calendar. And he's like, oh, I don't know if I know where it is. And like took a day to find it and then did produce it. And sure enough, there was an entry that said March 29th, Roy arrives or whatever it said, but it did have March 29th and it had been given to Detective Meyer. He had concealed it. Now, what the prosecution did try to do once that evidence was in was say like, okay, sure. But you know, when Detective Meyer came and visited you and asked for this and you gave it to him, whatever, this was two and a half years later, you could have written that at any time. And they did say like, this ink looks like it's a different color, you know, it looks different than the other entries from the same month, et cetera, et cetera. However, when you're talking reasonable doubt, like that does not look great.
Yeah. Again, this is, you're dealing with a case that there is no hard evidence.
Right.
This is all circumstantial. So all you have to do is put a little bit of doubt into the juror's mind. I'm not saying it's right, but that's all you have to do.
Yeah. So my guess, and I didn't read this, this is just kind of me reading between the lines. I think after he was kind of shown in the middle of the trial to have been concealing evidence, I don't think Detective Meyer's supervisors were like super happy with him because, again, this is the most expensive investigation in San Bernardino history. And that's not a good look for the police department. So Meyer ended up resigning from the force midway through this trial.
Can we put quotations around that resigning?
Oh yeah. He told reporters that he was leaving to be a private investigator in Las Vegas.
To which he probably was.
Well.
Oh, boy.
No, we have to sidebar a little bit because Detective Myers' story came to a bizarre end in 1986 when he was sentenced to 66 years in prison for a robbery and shootout at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas.
As he was the perpetrator?
Yeah, he held up 5 hotel guests and disarmed several security guards. He then used the guards as human shields and started a gunfight with their rescuers.
What?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so as far as I know...
Should have probably pursued that book deal.
I know, it would have been safer. Yeah. He was apparently eligible for parole after 22 years. I'm not sure if he got it. He might still be in prison. Anyway, yeah, weird ending for that guy. But so he kind of exits the story at that point. So get back to Roy's trial. Now, this trial went for 14 weeks. The detectives who appear to at first be the girl's saviors because, you know, they got this cold case hot, they ended up really being the people who prevented Tiffany and Brandy from getting justice. Despite the fact that items that Claude Wise reported missing from their home after the murder and kidnappings, including photo albums and a medical encyclopedia, were found in Roy's Oregon home, and despite all of the witness statements and the fact that they also found an autobiography of sorts that Roy had written that mentioned murder and kidnapping, Roy Summers was found not guilty of all charges on his 42nd birthday. Jurors deliberated for 14 hours and only needed one vote to come to their verdict. They had no dissent. After the verdict was read, Roy shook all of their hands and thanked them. As it was being read, Claude Wise stood up and yelled, quote, "This is the biggest injustice I've ever seen in my entire life," end quote. He then pointed a finger at Roy and said, quote, "Summers, I'll get you," end quote.
Always a good thing to do in the court of law.
You know what? It was over. Like, I don't blame him. Like, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know.
This was the most expensive investigation in San Bernardino's history up to this point, and it was botched so badly that Roy, along with his sisters, Charlene and Karen, and Lee and Molly Kasner, all filed separate suits against the San Bernardino Police Department for a total of $17 million. Summers claimed that officials, quote, conspired to manipulate and suppress evidence and continue to cover up these acts in order to obtain a criminal conviction, end quote. He was asking for $7 million in damages. His sisters and Lee Kasner were asking for $3 million apiece, and Molly Kasner was asking for $1 million. Karen had been put in jail for about a day and was never extradited to California. Lee had spent 4 months in an Oregon jail and was then released on probation. Molly said her civil rights were violated due to the harassment she faced from police. And Charlene, who was only subpoenaed as a witness, said that she was humiliated and faced income deprivation. The suit was eventually settled for $400,000, which I believe just ended up going to cover Roy's legal fees.
I'm more curious about the lead investigator, and I'm wondering, of course, no newspaper articles would have this, but I'm wondering if he was the main proponent in pursuing a lot of these things in the way that they did, more so than necessarily a DA or the police department, police chief, whatever. Yeah. I'm wondering if he was the driving force behind it, knowing that he was trying to get a book deal out of it afterwards.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was because of the book deal or it was just some misguided hero complex.
Yeah,
because like what this reads to me as is basically like every cop movie ever, right? Where like, you know,
we're going to strong arm these witnesses.
Yeah.
To
like
get
we
them
know
to
you're,
confess.
Yeah, we know you're guilty, but we don't have the evidence. So we're going to bend the rules and it doesn't matter because it's all about getting justice at the end and the ends justify the means. And in the real world, clearly that doesn't really work,
no, it doesn't.
Right? You know, you get jurors who see through this and who look at these cops and are like, what are you doing? Like, you can't do that. And the jurors were interviewed afterwards and they're like, yeah, the evidence wasn't there. The cops like clearly lied. Right. Like, you know, how like, can we convict him?
Look, even looking at this again, I keep going back to it. It's like, yeah, looking at all of the information that we have, clearly he's involved.
Right.
But there's still no direct evidence of the murder. And we have no kids. We have eyewitness testimony that they're out there or were out there.
Yeah.
But we have no kids. We have nothing tying him directly to the murder.
So there's a another site that I don't know who created it. It seems like it might have been created by somebody in Tiffany and Brandy's family, like somebody in the Wise family. It seems very personal and it's very much like Roy Summers yeah. murdered, you know, Beverly and kidnapped. Like it's very definitive about Roy doing it, you know? So not exactly like an objective source at all. Yeah, right.
And also let me just reiterate, I am not saying that I think he didn't do it.
Yes. But and what they say, and they do bring up a good point on this, is that despite the fact that this investigation was horribly botched and very unethical, that doesn't mean that a reasonable person, not necessarily the impaneled jury, right? Because right. you have rules that you have yes, to follow.
You have to follow, yeah.
But that's not any reason that a reasonable person looking at the evidence in totality should disregard all of the witness statements, right? Like, I don't think that all of these many neighbors in different states were suffering from some sort of mass hysteria or mass hallucination.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I just don't believe that they all saw some other kids.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's just not enough to get over the threshold to make that legal connection.
But that's the problem. I honestly think that there was. So I think that had this case been put together properly and had the evidence that was real and that did exist been gathered and packaged in a more cohesive and ethical way, I do think that there would have been enough circumstantial evidence to convict him. I really do.
I mean, that may be. I have bigger issues with the tactics of the investigation.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. The tactics of the investigation were what brought the whole thing down.
I don't think strong-arming witnesses and arresting people outright on these crazy charges that you knew weren't going to stick. I don't think that was the way to go about it. I think the better way to go about it was you have all the players. Yes, it's a lot.
Yeah.
But you have all the players involved, or at least most of them, enough to put surveillance on them and see what comes up. And hey, guess what? During that surveillance, if you find the kids, then that in and of itself is a win.
Right.
And then you can start retracing from what they say happened back to the murder. And even if you don't get the murder, you still have the kids.
Well, exactly.
Now we're out of everything.
Yeah. And the frustrating part, there are a couple frustrating parts about that, is one, police kept on saying throughout the entire investigation that their goal, they actually didn't care about prosecuting anyone. They just wanted the kids back.
Well, that's clearly bullshit.
Yeah. Well,
because they didn't pursue the children. They pursued the murder charge.
Right. Well, they pursued, but I mean, there was the murder and kidnapping, and they pursued the kidnapping charges with the accomplices.
They pursued the charges, but they didn't pursue the actual kids.
Right.
Is what I'm saying.
Yes. And I agree. But I do think that in their minds, they were going to get these people to talk and they were going to get these people to just tell them where the kids were. Right.
Just wait and watch.
Yeah, I know.
It's not like these kids didn't exist. Well, they were going to turn up.
Right. And that brings me to the second frustrating part, which is that from 1977 to 1980, because the last sighting was, again, like in January of 1980, these kids were not underground. They were at diners. Like,
yes.
They were at Sunday school, right. you yeah. know?
That's further. They weren't being. Point.
Yeah, yes. They weren't locked in a dungeon somewhere where nobody could get to them. They were out and about. And you're absolutely right. Had they taken a different tactic, had they taken a tactic that was not just okay, we're going to make somebody tell us where they are, and had they gone down the road of like, let's actually just try to find them ourselves, this whole thing could have ended differently. And you know, then so what we have is all these arrests, the sightings stop. So one of two things happened. The sighting stopped because the children were killed. Because at that point, I mean, if he was afraid of them being witnesses when they were 5 and 2.
Right. Whoever was holding them killed them.
So there's that. Or they were gotten rid of, right? They were shuttled off to, like I said at the beginning, either a completely unconnected family.
Right.
In some sort of shady adoption thing.
Right.
Or just some other offshoot of one of these families that wasn't under the radar. Yeah. Exactly. Right. So that would be the happy ending of sorts.
Yes.
To this. But in either case, Claude Wise, Stacy Wise are left without justice, left without answers. And Roy just went on to live his life. He got his money. He paid off his legal fees in 1986. And he continued to be a farrier. He continued to just move around and do his thing. He might have gotten married some more.
I was just going to say, how many wives did he have after that?
I don't know. I mean, the press kind of stopped covering him after that. He just lived, by all accounts, a pretty quiet life until his death in 2009. Lee Kasner, Molly Kasner, and Mike Iwakiri are also deceased now. But Juanita Iwakiri and Karen Carino and Charlene Beer, his other sister, are all still alive. Now, are they completely innocent as they have always claimed? Are they victim of corrupt detectives? Or have they all been carrying this secret around for over 40 years? A witness at Roy's Oregon assault trial said that she overheard Roy telling his mother in the courtroom that Juanita would never say anything because he had too much honor.
Well, that sounds fake.
Whether it is or it isn't, Roy has been dead now for over a decade. So even if it is true, what does it matter anymore? He's not around to tell anyone anything. Karen defended her brother to his death, as was evidenced by this glowing obituary that I found, like, to the point where I didn't even think it was the same person, because like Roy Summers is not the most unique name in the world. And so I found it and it was like such a glowing obituary that I'm like, oh, this has to be somebody else. But he was a farrier and it was definitely him. So I don't think Karen is ever going to come forward, because she, even at the beginning, she's like, he could never hurt a fly, despite the fact that...
I mean, there's evidence to the contrary.
Well, yeah. And this was even before the assault against his seventh wife. But it was after he had been jailed for rape, after he had already been, you know, jailed for multiple assaults, et cetera, et cetera. But she was still like, oh, he could never hurt anyone. So yeah, Karen's still around. Don't think she's ever going to turn on him in any way. So to me, Juanita is the key here. Juanita didn't make great decisions, but if that lawyer's testimony is to be believed, which I think it is, she tried to help those kids in her way. She was a mother. She is a mother. She has grown children now. She saw those kids. She took care of them. She wanted to adopt them, as wrong as the whole situation was.
Sure.
I'm not saying she was like the hero in this, but she was trying to help them in some way. Her husband is gone. I can't imagine anyone would bother prosecuting her for anything at this point, even if the statute of limitations weren't all gone, which I'm sure they probably are at this point.
by the way, she appealed her original conviction and won, partially because it was deemed that Aldridge was breaking attorney-client privilege by testifying, mm-hmm. and so that had to be thrown out, and et cetera, et cetera. So maybe now it's time. Like, it's over 40 years later. Maybe it's time for Juanita to come forward, to finally unburden herself and put this mystery to bed. Brandy Summers and Tiffany Wise have been missing since March 30th, 1977. Brandy was about 4 feet tall and 50 pounds when she went missing. She had blonde hair and blue hazel eyes. She had 2 3- to 4-inch surgical scars and a round nickel-sized surgical scar on her abdomen, as well as a scar on her face. Brandy often went by her middle name, Jondell. She may have been using the last names Beer, Carino, Iwakiri, Iwakin, and or Wise. She was suffering from cystic fibrosis and needed medication at every meal in order to digest her food properly. She was 5 years old when she went missing. She would be 49 today. Tiffany was 3'5" and around 40 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She had reddish blonde hair and blue hazel eyes. She has a surgical scar extending from behind her hairline to the back of her head. Tiffany may be using the last names Iwakin, Beer, or Kasner. If you have any information on what happened to Brandy and Tiffany, please contact the San Bernardino Police Department at 909-384-5142. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at @ATTWGPod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. Our research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!